Welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of episode 13 in the series. Today I'll be speaking with longtime nonviolent resistor Ed Canaan. In episode 14, we'll continue the discussion, hearing from both Ed and his longtime partner, Ann Tiffany. Our podcast has a distinguished list of activists who have sacrificed comforts of life by putting themselves on the line for peace and justice. We've interviewed folks like three-time nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize, Kathy Kelly, and Sister Megan Rice, whose nonviolent action at Oak Ridge Nuclear Facility was judged by the Washington Post and the New York Times as the greatest security breach in the United States nuclear program history. We had the pleasure of hearing former CIA White House analyst Ray McGovern, and many more, including Claire Grady, who was at this time awaiting trial in Georgia for her nonviolent direct action at the Kings Bay Trident missile base, and Frank Cadaro of Iowa, who has spent years in prison for nonviolently standing up to the lies of injustice. Today, we're honored to speak with Ed Canaan and Ann Tiffany, who have worked as a team of peace activists for decades. We'd like to hear the individual stories of the revolution to nonviolent direct action. Ed and Ann live in Syracuse, New York. So, Ed, let's start off with you to explore your evolution and the early years that you've experienced until now, which is May of 2019. That's sort of a long haul, obviously, but I'd just like to start off by asking you about your childhood and, what sort of formation situations that you, do you have to tell? What factors led you eventually to develop the amazing stands for justice that you have?
Well, I was born in Syracuse. My parents were born in Syracuse. I come from an intact middle-class family. Neither of my parents went to college. My dad and, to some extent, my mom were very active in community fairs. He was a longtime Republican, a real Nixon Republican. Good people. They taught us the golden rule early in life, and they believed in setting a good example as opposed to preaching to us. I went to local schools, graduated from Central Tech here in Syracuse, had several years of parochial school, which I wasn't very happy in. I was very relieved to get down to a public school, Central Tech. I went to Fordham College in the Bronx. At that time, it was a Jesuit college, hoping to get some kind of basis for the Catholic faith I was grew up in, but that I was leaving behind at that time. I didn't find the church very useful in terms of moral guidance. So I became kind of secular maybe in about the senior year of high school. And certainly as that secularity deepened with my 2 years with the Jesuits, I was not community-oriented or politically oriented in these early years myself. I quit college, worked for a year on construction, year and a half maybe, and then went up to Syracuse University at Maxwell School of Citizenship. Can't say I learned much about citizenship there, unfortunately. In fact, when I graduated from SU, Syracuse University, I was pretty naive politically. I don't think I'd gotten political tools to think with.
Yeah, so after college and after the Maxwell School, you're saying you weren't really impressed with their civic engagement, but when do you start gravitating to other things? What did you do? What those years right after college?
Well, it was the Vietnam War era. I, like anyone, sensible person, opposed the war, but didn't do anything about opposing the war. I was into what I would call privatism. I ended up being quite the little scholar.
What do you mean by that, quite the scholar? What?
I got into anthropology, was the field that I... You couldn't take anthropology at Fordham College because at that era, Catholic schools didn't provide an anthropology. But I did at SU, became very engrossed in it, did very well, impressed, you know, some professors there with my work. But even though I wasn't anti-war in any active sense, I was quite alienated from U.S. culture. So for the next, I'm not even sure how long, because time didn't mean a lot to me at that time, I became basically a hobo. I drifted from job to job quite deliberately, menial work, transient work.
In this area of New York State? Or
no, well, some. I started my first job out of college, was working in the cemetery and here in Syracuse.
What'd you do there?
Grounds, you know, just a laborer.
Dug
some graves, yeah. But basically, I started the hitchhike. I hitchhiked. Basically, I've been in all 50 states, most of that hitchhiking through. So I've had quite a number of jobs of a menial and transient nature all over the country. Well, I worked on a racetrack out in California, Santa Anita, you know, as a hot walker, you know, helping to cool down the horses after they've been exercised every morning.
The same race place where they're, it's going to make a major change, apparently, in horse racing in the United States because of all the deaths of horses up to May of 2019. The biggest problem was at Santa Anita, so I guess we can't blame you, because what year was this roughly?
Well, this would have been 66, 67, okay. 68.
All right.
And actually, you mentioned deaths at Santa Anita. The first day in the job, you know, a jockey got killed. The first day of the season, a jockey got killed just coming out of the starting gate. And Santa Anita is where Sirhan had worked, doing what I had been doing.
And that was 68 that Sirhan did his number on Robert Kennedy. So,
yeah, I was there before him.
You were there before.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so I mentioned I worked in a flower farm out in California. I was the only Anglo gringo, and the rest of the workers were, you know, they came out of Tijuana.
Cultivating and fertilizing and all that?
Well, yeah. It was, you know, raised beds of carnations. So it was a lot of irrigation.
After California, or maybe within California, what were some of the activities over that period of time that in your developing years?
Well, it might have been, I'm not sure of the year, might have been 68, 67. I hitchhiked back east. I was homesick for Syracuse and my family. So I hitchhiked across the U.S. in the winter with my gym bag and my sleeping bag. And that led me to realize I can go anywhere. It really expanded my consciousness in terms of empowering my mobility. So that began kind of a lifestyle for me.
You're listening to episode 13 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is longtime nonviolent resistor Ed Canan. Where did you go to after you came home from California, Syracuse, and you began to think about worldly ventures?
Well, I've been in dozens of countries. Once I felt I'd sort of seen the U.S. pretty well, I had a romance that broke up, and I decided to go lose myself on the road, and I went to Africa. I spent nearly 3 years in Africa, over two or three trips there, hitchhiking again.
Did you work there in Africa?
I spent a year in a one-room schoolhouse in Kenya, remote area, kind of nominally Quaker. So my visa had me as a missionary. I had to have a missionary status, and the Quakers rigged that up for me. So I taught for a year there, eighth graders, what British colonialists called Form 1. They ranged in age from probably 13 to 19. because in Kenya at that time, kids started school when their parents were prepared to let them not work in the
field. Did that politicize you in any way, your Kenya experience?
Well, I had a political orientation. I forgot to mention that at some point in there, I did a lot of reading. And at some point, I read Paulo Freire, his kind of classic Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which gave me an orientation toward trying to do what I could as a teacher to raise consciousness and get students thinking about their place in their world and how they might empower themselves and their people.
More of a Socratic attempt to draw the students out and let them speak instead of filling their heads with stuff.
Well, it definitely turned out that way. And I think I read Freire again. So I may have read the book twice because it's pretty dense. But I felt that I was doing my best to apply Freire's ideas, given the limits of the situation and my own limits. So one of the things that came out of the teaching was discovering that the best way to get my kids speaking English was to let them know that they could ask me any question they wanted. No bounds at all, whatsoever. And that was like sort of an intellectual stampede for them.
Well, within the British system, it's very often it's called chalk and talk. You put the material on the board and the kids put it in their books and then they give it back to you, right? So this was pretty radical stuff that you were into, trying to switch to Socratic type teaching. Moving on from there, what we're talking now about, what chronological time? This is the mid-70s. Where are we now?
I got to think about that a moment. I left for Africa in 79. So it was 79, early 80s. I should say I spent some time in South Africa. It was under apartheid then, doing my own study of, not in any academic sense, but just reading all I could about South Africa. And a lot of that was in the South African press, the English language press there. And what I found was that the English language press in South Africa was very critical of apartheid. So when I came back to the States in like 82, no, no, 80, would have been 81 maybe, what I found was here in the States, the mainstream media didn't have a clue about what apartheid was. So I got into writing letters to the editor, correcting what I was hearing, reading in the Syracuse Herald Journal, Syracuse Post Standard, and then involved in the anti-apartheid movement in Syracuse.
So you did get involved in Syracuse in the sense that you were
eventually
writing letters. And was there an organization here or any sort of action at that time about dealing with apartheid?
Well, the campus actually even had like a settlement, you know, a simulated settlement on the campus. And I would, you know, informally participate in that and in demonstrations here about apartheid.
Was there any direct action at that time, or was mainly education?
I wasn't involved in direct action here, and I'm not aware of it so much. It was sort of like this occupation of a section of the campus that became like
a little Soweto or whatever.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah. And I'd been in Soweto, by the way, just a few hours, which was illegal for a white person to have done what I was doing. For this interview, I should have made a little timeline, because I do get the...
Well, that's all right, because we're trying to work you up to some of the big stuff that you're doing today with drones. But I think it's good to sort of examine what led you in this evolution to take some people would say drastic action, action that would eventually lead you to jail and prison. But so by the 1980s, let's jump into that area.
Okay.
The 1980s, were you active at all with the Central American issues of that time?
No, I had hitchhiked through Central America in 69. And that was where I had my eyes opened, really, to the human condition and to the extreme poverty that I saw in Central America and didn't understand. And it was that poverty that led me to want to go on to grad school, which I did in the early 70s. I went to the New School for Social Research in New York City, which had kind of a leftist orientation, and that really raised my consciousness and helped teach me how to think politically. And before that, I hadn't been active at all politically.
The New School became an awakening, more or less. Putting all the stuff that you had been experienced together, the justice issues.
Yeah, it helped me frame what I'd seen.
So tell us a bit then, the move up into the 90s, for example, from the 80s to the 90s. Was it the New School that sort of framed your consciousness then, or what led you to become involved in the School of the Americas Watch?
In 1985, I met Anne, and we've been together for 34 years. So meeting with Anne, who was very engaged in the sanctuary movement at the time, that reignited my interest in Latin America.
Explain the sanctuary movement, if you will.
Well, the sanctuary movement was a movement here in the U.S. whereby refugees of the U.S. wars in Central America, the U.S. colonialism in Central America, came to the U.S. often illegally, and they weren't documented. And some of the more political and articulate ones among that group got sanctuary, which means that entities within the U.S. protected them by church affiliation so that they could, in some cases, live in a church or in church-supported situations that would protect them from the MIGRA, from what's now called ICE. And Anne was very involved in that. And then I kind of trailed along behind her in that. And lived with a Salvadoran family here in Syracuse, Slocum House, which became a hub for sanctuary in Syracuse, among several hubs. And that led to my kind of renewed curiosity about Central America. So in, I think it was December of 87, I hitchhiked down to Florida, caught a plane to Nicaragua. And it was an exciting time because the Sandinistas had thrown over the Somoza regime. And so I was there for several months. And then I hitchhiked up to Guatemala. And I joined a group called Peace Brigades International, which provided accompaniment to people that were like activists often, or labor leaders, or teachers who were threatened by death squads. And so by having a foreigner, especially a foreigner from one of the imperial countries, it provided protection for these people. It allowed them to go about their work at less risk. So I kind of found myself feeling like I was a part of an historical process, helping to these activists and labor leaders to do their work with much less chance of being abducted and killed. So I did that for about 6 months in Guatemala. There was a chapter of Peace Brigades in Guatemala at the time. And then I did about 6 months in El Salvador with Peace Brigades International. And my role there was, because my Spanish was so shaky, our team assigned me to be the bodyguard for Bishop Medardo Gomez, who was a Lutheran bishop that had kind of taken on the mantle of Bishop Romero, Archbishop Romero, after his assassination. So he too was targeted. I mean, his office had been blown up. He had actually been abducted by death squads, which somehow was released. So I was kind of stuck with him. I mean, I would sit outside his office every day, the reconstructed office in the church.
You're listening to episode 13 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is longtime nonviolent resistor Ed Canan.
So were you packing a gun at the time?
I was packing a camera.
A camera, okay.
Which I barely knew how to use. The idea is I could be a witness if anything went south, if you will. So I would go home with him every night, you know, sleep by the front door. His house wasn't very protected. We would always take a different vehicle, a different route, a different time to go home. And if we were at a stoplight, which people in El Salvador didn't respect very much anyway, we'd even drive up onto the sidewalk so we wouldn't be caught in traffic. So it was that sort of thing was going on for me in Latin America.
So now when you come back to the United States from Latin America, give us some information about how you eventually came to meet people like Charlie Littke and Roy Bourgeois.
Okay. I got involved with the School of the Americas issue. The School of the Americas is a U.S. terrorist training school, basically, for Latin American military and police officers.
It's still around?
Still around, but it's changed its name. It's now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. It's a way of camouflaging.
A little more difficult to remember, isn't
it? Right, yeah. Exactly. And it changed its name because this group called School of the Americas Watch was doing its best to expose its curriculum, and the graduates of the school, anti-insurgency school, and their heinous crimes. So at a certain point, I think it was around 96, the school closed under pressure from School of the Americas Watch, this human rights group that I'd been pretty active in, along with the founder is Father Roy Bourgeois, a Marian old missionary. It was a movement. Would you want to hear about the movement and how it grew?
Yeah, I'd like to hear about, I think our listeners would like to hear about what happened there at the school. Tell a little about the school itself, which is, I understand it, an infantry training school within Fort Benning itself.
Yes, yes.
And what did you and Roy and others do to try to oppose that?
Well, it started in about 89, I think, after the six Jesuits and their housekeeper and her daughter were assassinated by the Atlacatl Battalion in San Salvador, capital of El Salvador. And this battalion had trained at the School of the Americas in infantry tactics, but was broader than infantry, anti-insurgency tactics, interrogation, torture. In fact, there was a manual which came to be called the Torture Manual, in which these soldiers of various Latin American countries learned how to torture. Not that they didn't know beforehand, but this maybe was a refinement of the technique. I'm not sure. There was a lot of death squad activity that had that was sanctioned by the various governments down there who were receiving U.S. military aid. And, of course, training at the School of the Americas, but also elsewhere in the U.S., other sites as well. So the six Jesuits were killed, their housekeeper and her daughter. So in the wake of that, Father Roy Bourgeois began this resistance against the School of the Americas to expose it. And it began with a distinct orientation toward what's called civil disobedience. But actually, it's civil resistance, because they weren't disobeying the laws. They were trying to enforce the laws against torture and killing and that kind of stuff. So when I first got involved, having had the background in the sanctuary movement with Anne, and having traveled in Latin America with Peace Brigades International, I heard Father Roy speak here in Syracuse, very compelling speaker, in a church basement where I'd already met Anne for the first time in that same church basement. So he called for a 40-day fast on the steps of the Capitol in Washington. And I decided to join that.
What year was that, Ed?
I would say 93,
okay.
Maybe.
All right, that's close enough. Yeah.
I think I went down after the 40-day fast, which Anne participated in also for part of that time. So then every year in November, on the anniversary of the Jesuits' assassinations, Roy called to have some action. And the first time I went down, maybe it was 93, there was about a dozen of us. And we went into the base, demonstrated, were arrested. And I got a sentence of 2 months in federal prison for that. Roy, I think, got a sentence of 6 months or so. But he had already been in prison a number of times, which really impressed me, because Roy spent as long a time in prison as I had spent as an undergraduate. You know, like about 4 years altogether. So Ann and I would go down to Georgia every November, around November 16th, the anniversary, and participate in, sometimes it was like a week long, participate in the demonstrations down there, which usually involved the civil resistance and arrests. It kept growing year by year. So at one point there were 400 or 500 arrests. And because I was a recidivist, I'd been arrested in prison before, my sentence was 6 months. But as part of that, in order to sort of drum up some attention before the November action, a handful of us did an action in November, which involved, at the main gate, putting bloody handprints.
It's the main gate of Fort Benning.
Fort Benning, yeah. Putting bloody handprints on the sort of this entry sign, and also writing graffiti, stenciling graffiti called saying SOA equals torture. Well, for that, a handful of us, including Charlie Litke and Kathleen Rumpf and our Jesuit friend from Washington State, Father Bixel, SJ, who had been a college dean earlier in his life, had a trial. I was sentenced to a year for destruction of government property, as I think we all were, pretty much. So that combined with a six-month sentence for trespass meant a 16-month sentence, which I served in a minimum security prison in Pennsylvania. These actions led to School of the Americas Watch annual event growing on an upward curve to the point where when I joined it, there was a dozen doing actions. And then at its peak, it was sort of like 2,000.
Explain a little bit about that for people who don't really know anything about what was going on at that time. Thousands of people at the gate of the largest infantry training school in the United States and the whole world, in fact, Fort Benning. Now, were the gates open when people would walk in, or what was going on at that time?
Well, Fort Benning was an open base. You can get a city bus and go on the base until 9/11, actually. Then it became a very heightened security situation with triple fencing, with barbed wire and so forth.
So initially you just walked right in?
We could drive in. Private cars could
drive. Yeah, but I mean with those of you who did resistance, nonviolent direct action, when you went in, what happened to you? When you walked into that base?
Well, you'd have to walk almost a couple of miles to get to any real buildings on its campus, if you will. But we'd drive in cars, maybe be left off, and then we'd go to the main hub of the School of the Americas College there, and then we would demonstrate with signage.
Mm-hmm.
Or one time, we dug graves. There were various actions each year that we would do on the base.
What about you associated with guys like Roy, of course, Roy Bourgeois, Father Roy Bourgeois, and who has since then been defrocked, which is an interesting point.
Yes.
And we'll be interviewing Roy in a matter of a couple of months, but also with another former Catholic priest by the name of Charlie Litke. Charlie's gone now. Could you sort of let people know who Charlie Litke was?
Sure. Charlie was a chaplain in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and he won a Congressional Medal of Honor for heroism under fire. He he dragged wounded soldiers under fire. You know, many of them. I mean, I don't dozen, two dozen. I'm not sure of the numbers.
I've read 16. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
So he was very heroic. And then after his time in Vietnam, he became an anti-war activist, very active with Roy in the School of the America's Watch.
By this time, he had already given up his medal, the Congressional Medal of Honor,
right,
which we have on film, Lyndon Johnson presenting him with this Congressional Medal of Honor. But what was the story behind that, where he got rid of it, right?
Yeah, with some other veterans, you know, they tossed their medals onto, was it?
The Vietnam Memorial,
on the
I think.
Memorial, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I understand it's now today in the United States Army Infantry Museum in Washington, D.C.
This Congressional Medal.
The Congressional Medal of Honor, yeah.
Well, he was quite a guy. It was an honor to be in his presence, like an honor to be in the presence of Roy Bourgeois. So he was one of us that year did the remodeling of the sign at the entrance of the base. And he's also spent quite a bit of time in prison. And he died, what, a couple of years ago?
Yeah, just 2 years ago.
Yeah.
You're listening to Episode 13 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is longtime nonviolent resister Ed Canan.
So it's an ongoing story with the School of the Americas, now the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. But you've left that. You didn't leave it. You still have it in mind, and you're even thinking of going down the 30th anniversary of the assassination of the Jesuits, which, by the way, you didn't get into totally, but we're talking about tens of thousands of people who were assassinated by graduates mm-hmm. of the U.S. Army School of the Americas. But with all of that history behind you, you come back to Syracuse and you recognize in your own backyard that there's sort of an assassination program going on here. Could you let us know what that was all about?
Sure. On the northern edge of Syracuse is our international airport, and contiguous to that is a military base, Hancock Military Base. It's the home of the 174th attack wing of the New York State National Guard. And back in 2009, we started reading in the local papers that it was going to become the hub for Reaper drone training. Now, drones are robots, flying robots, for surveillance, and that can be weaponized. And so Hancock drones, which were remotely piloted from Hancock, the actual drone, which is an airplane, but it's unmanned. There's no crew on board. It's just controlled from pilots at Hancock and other bases, too, around the world and around the country to drop bombs, Hellfire missiles, at targets. Hancock has acknowledged that it uses these weaponized Reaper drones in Afghanistan. After that acknowledgement back in about 2009, 2010, it kind of zipped its lips and realized that what it thought was a very cool, great thing for military publicity was getting resistance. Here in New York State, we were resisting Hancock, and other half a dozen other places, at least around the country, developed resistance to these operations. And so it became very classified. So now it's very hard to get any information out of the base about what it does. It's predations. It's assassinations in a handful of countries that we know about, mostly in what I call the Islamic oil lands, mm-hmm. the Middle East. These include Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, and places in Africa. Mm-hmm. So having read about this in the paper, the local papers really played up this new asset out at Hancock. I mean, it was front page stories. periodically.
They gave it a positive spin.
Oh, very positive spin. Never mentioning the illegality of the operation or the inhumanities of the operation. So a handful of activists from around upstate New York kind of got together. And in 2010, I think it was, we staged a public demonstration out at the base, in which 200 or 300 people came. So that led to trespass charges, disorderly conduct charges, for there was the so-called Hancock 38. We did a die-in in front of the main gate. And this led to a trial in the town of DeWitt, where the base was part of the town of DeWitt. And it led to, some jail time for most of us, many of us. And it led to us being fined the maximum. It was a maximum sentence for some of us, and then a maximum fine, which came out to be like $350 or $375, which some of us refused to pay. But we sent that money to a peace group in Afghanistan, a young peace group.
So was that the trial that Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States, actually came and testified?
Yeah, Ramsey came, and he was on the stand for 4 hours.
Wow.
The first 2 hours was the prosecutor, assistant district attorney, questioning him on his bona fides, his credibility as an expert on international law. Well, he had been the Attorney General of the United States, so it was very farcical. And then the next couple of hours was just questioning him about the drones, in which he was very explicit about the violating international law.
Well, that was a major coup, though, on your part, right, on all of you people involved, because after that, they pretty much didn't allow any expertise on international law, right?
Yeah, they didn't care to have our witnesses generally. Yeah. Although we were able to subpoena the base commander at one point.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I've lost track of the number of trials. But once or twice each year since 2010, we've done these actions at the base, and we've had these arrests. Invariably, we were arrested and come to trial.
Always nonviolent.
Scrupulously nonviolent, yes.
Can you tell us some of the more, maybe, what would you say, creative sorts of activities you guys had at Hancock?
Well, we've had several die-ins at the entrance of the base. And we've also had, one of the things we would do is we would bring an indictment for war crimes to the base. You know, there's a guard shack. We come up to the guard shack and to hand it over to the guards, who sometimes wouldn't take it, you know. Sometimes they did. That was addressed to the commandant in the chain of command, making it clear that we weren't doing civil disobedience by so-called trespassing or blocking, but we were doing civil resistance, which meant that we were enforcing our own laws, laws against assassination, international laws against invasion, and so forth. There's Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, which declares that we have to obey international law, because international law is supreme, the supreme law of the United States. I mean, it's generally ignored by the U.S. government, but the U.S. government is signatory to this international law. And it's also generally ignored by the court system. And certainly that was the case in DeWitt, New York, where we go to court. Other elements of these actions were kind of theatrical in the sense we would have some very interesting banners and very interesting props. One banner I recall, which was quite long, maybe 25 feet long, that we stretched across the entrance of the base, was "Drones fly, children die." And we would sometimes have simulated bloodied bodies.
Weren't you crucified there once in front of the drone base?
Well, on Good Friday several years ago, we used these drone models as kind of like crosses. And then several of us would be crucified.
Were you arrested for that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We'd get arrested each time we would do these kind of dramatic actions. Another time we had like 30 or so life-size pictures, if you will, of Jerry Berrigan, the late Jerry Berrigan brother to more famous Berrigan brothers, Dan and
Phil.
Phil. We had them stretched across the entrance.
You're listening to episode 13 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is longtime nonviolent resistor Ed Canan.
I often wonder, with all the work that your team up here, and you and Ann have been such strong leaders of this team, why is it that people around the country, around the world, feel kind of comfortable with drone assassinations? Maybe that's not the way to phrase it, but they don't seem to have any serious protests to this. Why do you think that is?
Well, there are some serious protests. I mean, from our point of view, it's minuscule compared to what needs to be protested. But let's just take Syracuse in Hancock Air Base. One, the air base hires, you know, several hundred people. So this is a jobs issue, which is kind of universal, I'm afraid, in this country in terms of being concerned about militarism, because we think of it as the military providing jobs, which is illusory because actually they divert hundreds of billions of dollars from areas that would be good for the country, education, health, housing, and that would provide many more jobs. Mm-hmm. So it's a fallacy that the military provides jobs.
Well, didn't
overall.
The Catholic bishop of Syracuse actually tell you personally once that there are a lot of local people who work at Hancock?
Yeah, curiously, Bishop Cunningham did point that out, that in a sense, some of those workers are part of his flock. Mm-hmm. You know, a handful of us did meet with him and try to awaken him to the problem of this assassination and these bombings originating in his diocese. He was polite. He was amiable enough, but mm-hmm. didn't seem to grasp the moral dimension of what was happening at Hancock.
Didn't he, from what I heard, say that it does prevent boots, you know, our boots from not being on the ground in foreign countries?
Well, yes, that's the mantra as well. Drones save lives. Well, there is a role for drones in combat to surveil the so-called enemy, in which has some tactical advantage. I mean, sort of something I say is that the drones are tactically clever, but strategically stupid, not to mention morally heinous. But by strategically stupid, I mean that drones are terrorism. That's sort of the major thing they do, is they terrorize a whole region, leading to refugees, leading to displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. Also, it leads to blowback, by which I mean that if you assassinate, you kill, you wipe out a whole family with your Hellfire missile, for every death, there are survivors, and there are family and friends and fellow villagers who feel enormous hatred toward the U.S., this evil force that's killing. And this can fuel terrorism, what's called terrorism. Now, in the U.S., we think of terrorism as something they do, the dark-skinned people against us, whereas in fact, most terrorism is state terrorism. It's perpetrated by people in uniform against civilians, sometimes directly and deliberately, other times as so-called collateral damage. It also allows for aggression, which is illegal by the UN Charter, to happen outside of declared war zones, which means that the cauldron keeps boiling, keeps fueling conflict and resistance, you know, throughout the region. And throughout the world, in a sense. They see the U.S., much hated the U.S. because of its terrorized, you know, its high-budget, systematic, extremely unjust killings. It leads to a lot of hostility to the U.S. and to U.S. interests. So, in a way, the drones may save life in a very constricted context of combat, where the U.S. forces shouldn't be in the first place. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia.
On that point, we know that Bush was the guy who pretty much started. Bush, too, was the one that began to first use drones in the last 15 years or so. Then, of course, Obama came in, and many more drones used by Obama. So it's both political parties, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this third individual who came in, who was supposed to be somewhat of an independent away from even the Republicans themselves, but has captured the Republican Party, he has increased it to numbers beyond Obama. So, but you hardly ever hear of this. People almost never hear of drone killings. And when it is, it's on the back pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post. Why is this, I guess I'd have to ask, and how do we get this to the Americans, the attention of American people? You have been arrested, and so many other people, you know, have been arrested and gone to jail. Is there any way that you foresee that we can bring this to the attention, or is it that Americans simply don't care, that they feel that it's not a big deal? What's your take on this with your long experience with this drone issue?
Well, I think U.S. people live at a level of materialism and consumption that deadens their mind, that deadens their consciousness. And most of us don't want to lose that level of consumption. So we've been co-opted. We also live with an extreme level of distraction. You know, it's bred in circuses. The athletics, sports, commercialized sports. There's a whole section in the paper. You know, like one of three sections in the local paper is the sports section. That is so foremost in the mainstream media's activity and in a lot of people's minds. I mean, they're fans. They've been taught to be fans since they could toddle, you know. So there's that. So there's co-optation, there's distraction, and there's also addiction. We're a very addicted society, whether it be to alcohol, drugs, shopping. And this muddles our minds, these things. The other thing that goes on, I think, in the U.S. society is debt. People are deeply in debt, which is, you know, connected to the consumerism. And also what they have to pay, you know, in terms of tuition. I mean, so many college graduates graduate owing tens of thousands of dollars, which means if they get a job, and some don't, that they're trapped. They can't risk losing their job. They can't risk speaking out. So this has such an impact, these things, on U.S. people. Also, our mainstream media, in many cases, is owned by billionaires who have their class interests. And it really shapes how the U.S. people learn about how the world is working, what's going on in the world, what the role is of the Pentagon. You know, the Pentagon is the greatest terrorist organization on the planet.
You're listening to episode 13 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is longtime nonviolent resistor Ed Canan.
Are we into a new era now when young people are beginning to speak out and question this whole system that your generation has been involved in over the years, that is to use terror as a source of American diplomacy? Is there any positive spin that we might find out there? Is there any hope left? It sounds kind of bleak what we have been doing as an instrument of terror.
Well, you know, Bishop Romero, before he was assassinated by a School of the Americas grad, said something to the effect that don't depend on hope. So the dialectic of that will lead to despair. And I'm somewhat in that camp, you know. At a certain level, I have hope because I think doing what I do is worthwhile. if only if it can reduce the pain, the suffering. But some people, I think, kind of hold in their mind this hope that things will always get better, which I think is illusory. I mean, I don't hold that view. I try not to rely on hope that things will get better. I think mine is sort of the inverse or the obverse, which is that you work so that things won't get worse.
The final question would be then that if we're not talking about hope, I guess we're talking about just a lot of action. We're not talking about how effective you're going to be, but simply to face the evils and to resist. So is this going to be what you'll do for the rest of your life, you and Anne and others who are in this system? You're just going to resist right down the line?
Well, you remind me of Dorothy Day's, you know, mantra about, you know, she was one of the co-founder of the Catholic Workers. I don't consider myself a Catholic, but I am sort of a fellow traveler of the Catholic Worker. And she said, don't focus on effectiveness, focus on faithfulness. Do what's right. Be true to yourself. Be true to your community. And that's really your job, not just be calculating what's effective. At least don't focus on that exclusively. So there's that. Will I, and I can't speak for Anne, be doing this for the rest of my life? You know, I'm not sure. I'm very aware of my own aging. It's hit me pretty heavily, both mentally and physically. So to what extent I'll continue to be able to do what is I find meaningful for me, I'm not sure.
Do you find that many people out there that you could pass the baton to, younger people?
Well, yeah, I think locally there's a lot of activism going on, particularly around immigrants, you know, against undocumented people. This area that we're in central New York has a lot of dairy farms and a lot of that depend on undocumented workers who sometimes are living in some pretty poor, precarious situations. And there's activism around that.
So you're saying that it's more of a domestic interest rather than foreign interest? It doesn't matter about poor farmers in Afghanistan as far as our the young people you're going to be passing the baton to, that they are more focused on regional American things?
Well, I think there's really insufficient awareness of the international, of the distant. I think there's very insufficient awareness of the domestic problems here, you know, the entrenched racism in this nation, of the entrenched, continuous devouring of scarce resources, of polluting the environment, of climate disaster, climate catastrophe, which is moving in on us so quickly. And I think some young people are quite aware of this. Yeah. You know, we saw videos of this youngster, 16-year-old youngster of Sweden, Greta. I mean, she's brilliant, and I think she's probably very inspiring to a lot of young people. So there's that hope, if you will, of some conscience being changed.
A Green New Deal, which would include a reduction of militarism, right? Thanks, Ed. There's so much for you to say and so much that we missed, like your 2003, you know, existence at the shock and awe where you were right there when
in Iraq,
when the bombs fell. But maybe that'll be for the next interview we have with you.
You've been listening to episode 13 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy. And my guest has been longtime nonviolent resistor, Ed Canan. We'll conclude this conversation in episode 14 and also hear from Ed's partner, Ann Tiffany. You can find related links on our blog, nonviolentdirectaction.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.